Working Cows Podcast, Episode 15.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
This episode has been brought to you in part by Kamak Ranch Supply. Check out their website at kamakranchsupply.com. This episode is also brought to you by chriswilliamsaudio.com. Head on over to chriswilliamsaudio.com for all your audio production needs. Howdy, everybody. I wanted to take some time as I introduce this episode to make sure that you are aware of my wife's blog. She is blogging weekly, workingcows.net/blog. workingcows.net/blog. So go ahead and check that out. Released at the same time as these episodes right there on Monday mornings. So be sure to check that out. I would also encourage you to check out the show notes page for this episode, workingcows.net/15, workingcows.net/15. Today on the show, we have Joe Mills. Joe is a producer from Indiana. He is a fourth generation producer who has come alongside his dad, who was an early adopter of the no-till farming system and has made his farming practice decisions with conservation and stewardship in mind. Joe has been part of the operation since 2003 and continues the tradition of leaving the land in better condition than it was before they found it. As a fourth generation of Mills farming in Indiana, Joe and his wife Kelly look forward to being able to leave a great legacy of farming for their children if they choose to farm. Joe, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on. I'd like to give you an opportunity to share a little bit about what you're doing there and how things kind of look on your operation.
Yeah, Clay, thanks for having me. Just sitting out here on a nice, dreary winter day in west central Indiana. All the chores are done, and now we get to talk to you.
Yeah, it's good to have you. So what are your days like this time of year?
Days this time of year, it seems like there's always a lot of trucking to do on the grain side, and then lots of hay to take out on the cattle side and make sure everything's eating and healthy, and wean calves aren't getting sick, and just making sure everything's in order.
So what is your enterprise mix looks like then on your operation?
We're pretty diversified. We've got the cattle, which are mostly Black Angus. We started out with eight heifers probably about 20 or 25 years ago and kind of grew our own herd from there. We've got a little bit of color in our herd now. We've bought some couple groups of calves to feed out, and using the old eye test, we had a few heifers that we thought we might like to save, so kind of diversifying that way. I don't know if that's right or wrong to the purist, but it is what it is, and we'll keep saving our Angus heifers off the GeneMax test. And then on the grain side, we typical Midwestern row crop farm, corn, soybeans, wheat, alfalfa, oats, and peas for cover crops, and rye for cover crop. Probably expand on that mix too.
Sure. I was sitting in a Dave Pratt workshop last week, and he said that a good cow is a cow with a good gross margin, period. So,
if only they all had great gross margins.
Right, right. Yeah. But, you know, I think we get hung up on color. We get hung up on a lot of things, I think, as humans, that the cows don't care, and the guy eating the meat on his plate probably doesn't care, you know, unless somebody tells him otherwise. He might care then.
I don't think you're going to find a lot of people that can tell you if that cow was black or white or red. And as long as a cow has a calf and gets it on the ground and it's healthy and it gains fast and finishes well, mission accomplished.
Sure. You said you were buying in some calves to finish. What does that look like for you guys?
You know, we'll just buy some of the neighbor's calves, nothing in potloads like out west. Here, the the cow herds are really small. I mean, we don't run hundreds of cows or calve out 1,000 heifers a year. You know, typical cow herd here is probably maybe 40 would be the average. So we'll buy groups of anywhere 15 to 70 at a time and finish out those.
Sure. Gotcha. And what are you using to finish those out with?
Well, it's pretty simple. We don't get too fancy. We don't have a TMR, or our lots aren't set up that way. I kind of wish they were. But we have them on pasture where they can access grass at all times. Always have a bale of hay if they need it. And then we finish them out on as much corn as they want to eat. We'll mix that corn with our own old-style grinder mixer and throw whatever mineral we need in there. And, you know, we harvested our own rye this year, and we had some left over, so we'll feed them a little bit of rye. I remember my grandfather, he's a little bit more adventurous and frugal. He'd come home with a bakery truckload of expired bread or sweet rolls. I've seen 55-gallon drums of taffy.
Yeah, you got to make something work. You know, you got to find those untapped resources that are kind of specific to your region. And is there's some things that you're doing along those lines today, right?
Yeah, of course, we're in corn country. Corn is king. We don't have a lot of silage feeding going on here like we used to. You could drive half a mile to a mile in any direction. Somebody's got a silo feeding calves, but those days are pretty well gone here. There are a couple silos still in use in the county, but when we switched our corn acres over to the non-GMO corn back in 2013, we decided to market our beef as non-GMO fed beef. We've got a pretty densely populated area out here, fairly. We've got a small college here in town, and that kind of caters to that crowd. We've got Indianapolis. That's about 40 miles east of here, and we ship fat calves, just a few of them every week, to a local processor. They've got 3 retail locations around Indianapolis, and that's kind of how our beef gets out and about. We've got a little store in town. It's kind of like a co-op or 12-month farmer's market with 3 other vendors. We supply our little town with beef that way, too.
Cool. Would you mind diving in a little bit onto the providing beef year-round to a local store? Is there some considerations there as far as the size of the calf that you're taking to slaughter, or how is that working?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. We deal with a couple of the local processors, like I was talking about, and then that store. It really kind of depends on who you're selling to. We've got one processor that really likes them finished at 1,200 pounds, and then another processor that, you know, I hauled in 1,500-pound calves this week, and they were loving it. So it depends on what their customers are and then what they need to fill that niche. As far as the little store in town that we're a part of, you know, it's a great way to get rid of heifers. Those heifers might only finish out the smaller end at 1,000, then up to maybe 1,250 or 1,300 pounds, but it seems like the heifers never bring as much on the open market, so it's a little bit of added value to us to be able to market that beef that's a little bit lighter weight or the wrong sex to that store in town.
Sure, and then are you grinding all that meat, or is it some of it going into steaks, or how is that marketed?
We actually cut it up like a freezer beef customer would want. So we've got the ground on there. We've got the steaks, the ribeyes, the fillets, whatever you want in there. We've got a few loyal customers that always want a tongue or a kidney or a heart, so that gets used up too. And speaking of ground, if we get a cull cow out here, we'll throw in the feedlot for a little while and get her a little juicy, and that makes some really good ground.
Absolutely. What kind of difference do you see as far as the weigh-up price versus what you're able to sell her for through a slaughter plant?
Well, right now, cull cows like that are probably bringing, I'd say, 50 to 60 cents at the local sale barn. Most of the farmers do not ship direct to a packer plant here. Seems like there's more middlemen than we know what to do with, but So we can take that 50 or 55 cent cow and feed her a little bit and then turn that around and get probably about $1.80 to $2 for her, you know, by the time it's all said and done.
Sure. Yeah. And how many days are you talking about feeding her?
Probably about 90.
Sure.
You know, if she's a younger one, 90. Now, if it's an older one, eight or 10 year old cow, she's not going to put on hardly anything. It just kind of depends on the shape at that age. If we do want to grind her for that store, or if we just want to ship her on down the line and not worry about her.
Sure. Yep.
We try to keep the quality high. Choice is where we're at most of the time. We do put some prime in there when we can.
Absolutely. That's a good strategy. We had a talk with Aaron Berger of Nebraska Extension, and he talked about cow depreciation and some of the things that we talked about as ways to mitigate that risk of cow depreciation are some of the things that you're talking about with taking those heifers. I'm assuming these heifers that you're feeding out are heifers that fell out of the breeding herd, came up open or something?
Some of the heifers are parts of the groups of calves that we've bought, and we don't have enough room to save every heifer we get through here. So those typically will go in the feedlot no matter what, because we don't know the genetics on those, and we don't know enough about to even test with something like GeneMax. We're not really sophisticated to look at the marbling with ultrasound here, so you know, that's one way we could check, I guess, if we really wanted to do it. But the heifers from our own herd that we test, they're the bottom dwellers of the GeneMax test. You know, we try to keep the ones that score in the top 20% of what we get back, and the rest go out to the feedlot. And it's kind of interesting to see, and you know way more about this than I do, I'm sure, but how those tests are getting really correlated to what we see in the feedlot.
More and more accurate all the time, I think, huh?
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Yep. And so are you guys marketing any calves in the fall? Or I guess maybe we should talk about calving season first before we ask that question.
Yeah, typically we calve everything in the spring. We've had a couple hot dry spells, and it kind of backed up some of the cows that didn't get bred. And we just preg checked the whole herd and kind of gave us a good opportunity to start a fall calving herd too. So we'll have our first fall calves in 2018. That way we've got the two calving groups. We can spread out our cash flow. And then it also helps with marketing those calves when they get slaughter weight. We can have a little bit more of a steady stream throughout the year.
Sure. Are you guys basically feeding everything out then? Pretty much you're not taking anything as a calf to the sale barn?
No.
Right.
Everything gets fed out.
Sure. We are talking with Joe Mills today, also known as the Hippie Farmer on Twitter. If you want to follow him, his a link to his Twitter page and the website will be on the show notes page. So if you want to follow Joe, go over to the show notes page at workingcows.net, and we will link you to his Twitter profile and his website. We're going to take a quick break and thank our sponsors, and then we'll be right back for more with Joe Mills. This episode has been brought to you by Chris Williams Audio. Check out his website at chriswilliamsaudio.com. For the last 11 years or so, I've been talking for a living. I've gained some skills in talking. I can form a sentence. I can think on my feet. I can respond to questions. I can come up with new questions. All that time developing my speaking craft has not left me a lot of time to figure out how to make audio sound great. If you're a musician, podcaster, or filmmaker, making your product sound great is crucial. So you stick to what you know, and let Chris Williams stick to what he knows, making your product sound great. Head on over to chriswilliamsaudio.com for all your podcasting, music production, and film audio needs. We're back with Joe Mills, and we're talking to him today. And on his Twitter profile I mentioned earlier, at the Hippie Farmer, the pinned tweet at the top says, "We only get one life to farm. I'm not going to spend it doing what everyone else does. I hope all my neighbors think I'm crazy." Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. As in my short farming career, I realized that we're doing corn and we're doing beans, and we're doing corn and we're doing beans. And then we got to the wheat and added that in, and wheat's not very common out here. And then we started doing the cover crops and the no-till, and we've got some pretty large growers around us, and they are, you know, the ground pounders, so to speak, and that system works for them, and that's fine with it. But we're just a little different. When you drive by down the highway, you're going to see some green fields in the wintertime and our drill running in the fall after the combine, and I'm sure more people than I know wondering just what the hell we're doing out here. And I've even got some old-time neighbors who have been around farming all their life just stopping and saying, what are you growing out there? You know, we can't figure it out. And really, it's just oats or the winter peas, and because it's a mix and maybe nobody's really seen the winter peas around here, they're kind of stumped. So it gets good conversations going, but it's definitely made some people scratch their heads out here, and it's kind of fun. I don't go to the coffee shops. I don't have time for it. That's a sore subject with me, but, you know, if people think I'm off my rocker a little bit, so be it. You know, talking about people is what they want to do. That's great.
So what are some of your motivations for the winter peas and the alfalfa and rye and oats? Is that kind of your cover crop that you're talking about?
Alfalfa we use for hay, and we get that established with a cover crop of oats. Makes really, really great hay, and we'll wrap that, and it turns into really good baleage. The oat and winter pea mix, so it's interesting that you brought that up because that kind of dives off into a whole other direction of where our farm is going. Those are ahead of what's going to be our first organic corn crop of 2018. So we want a little cover out there to try and suppress some wheat growth. And then the oats will kill. They're almost dead now. And the peas will keep out there and pump a little bit of nitrogen in the ground ahead of that corn crop. The rye, we'll plant soybeans into standing rye, and it's been really great for wheat suppression, water holding capacity.
What are your goals with the cover crops? What are you trying to do? You mentioned putting nitrogen back into the ground. Is it also keeping a living root in the ground? Is that?
Keeping a living root in the ground. The more we go with this, the more we're seeing the benefits of that. I mean, those roots, alive or dead, they're feeding things in the soil, and there's more stuff going on than we can see with our eyes. There's so many unnamed organisms. But back to what's going on top, or what's going on top of the ground, our number one goal was erosion. We're real light soil here. We're kind of rolling. You know, we'll get some wind, and even in the no-till system, I didn't expect wind erosion to be a factor at all, but it can be. And we get to see that in the snowbanks, so it's really nice when we've got a good, healthy cover crop of rye. The wind blows or the rain comes, and our soil is held. And we can see the difference just crossing a fence line to our neighbors where they've worked that ground, and it'll blow away, you know, when it gets dry and they're planting, or it'll wash away. You know, we can see in some of those other fields where water has washed away the topsoil, clear down to where the clay tiles are, and now those are exposed. You can't put that back, but that topsoil is running down on us, so be it.
Right. I remember I grew up in western South Dakota, and so there is not a lot of crop ground out here. There is some irrigation here and there. A lot of that is alfalfa for hay to be fed to cows. There's some corn, not as much as there is when you get farther east. And when I went to Bible school, I was going out to Wisconsin, and I drove through my first blackout, which was a bare cornfield, and the wind was blowing across it, and it was just black soil blowing across the field, and I couldn't hardly see. You know, I'd driven through a lot of whiteouts in western South Dakota, but that was my first blackout.
Yeah, that would make my skin crawl.
Why is that?
Just, you know, that soil that's blowing off. I mean, whether it's our property or somebody else's, you know, how many years does it take to make what's blown away right in front of your face? You can't just go put that back the next day with a spreader. I mean, I guess if it all blew up against a building and you could use a loader, but, I mean, it's gone.
Yeah. It's not how it happens typically. You know, it goes around the building. It goes into the trees. It goes – you can't recover it, like you said. And it's, you know, you get – we only get one lifetime to farm, but you also only get one – set of topsoil essentially to work with, and that, I think that's a lot of what you're talking about with erosion is keeping that topsoil in place and healthy.
Yeah, my grandmother is from southern Oklahoma, and she lived through the Depression and the Dust Bowl out there. And hearing the stories that those people went through back at that time is something I never, ever want to experience. You know, NRCS has some really good conservation programs out here, and okay, you put a buffer strip in, that's great. You put some evergreens in, that's great. It's kind of got me thinking, you know, we work so hard at tearing out tree lines because they're yield robbers, and I think, you know, that's definitely key to economic efficiency, but, you know, maybe go back in and plant some of those buffer strips or evergreens. Those aren't going to take away near the yield as the big hardwoods do, and that's something we've got to keep in mind. I mean, every inch of every acre isn't everything. That little bit that we try to use to conserve with is probably going to pay us back many times over the years just for a little bit of sacrifice.
Sure. Yep. And it's an ecosystem, right? You know, we're managing an ecosystem. We're not just trying to flatten out as much ground as possible to put in as many acres of corn or beans as we can.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a cycle and everything is here. Nature's got its own way it wants to work. And, you know, really, we've gone in here as a group of farmers, you know, especially over the last 100, 150 years as machinery has evolved and just tore that cycle down. And one thing in the organic system that we've seen, and this will get me in all kinds of arguments about whether organic's good or not, but it's true. We have seen the benefit to working with nature start to come back. And, you know, our agronomist who sees all kinds of different farming systems, he said, you know, he just can't believe how fast the soil has turned around in a couple of these fields that have been just tilled and tilled and tilled, and then we start the organic process on there, and, you know, it's kind of like a resurrection, so to speak. You know, I'm not going to say that same thing is going to happen in Iowa where it's deep and black and that soil is pretty good to start with, but you're going to put at least some help back into it and get a little ecosystem under the ground going again.
Sure. You know, you got a lot of, when I talk to my dad and talk about getting started, which is where I'm at right now, trying to get started in the ranching industry, and he said that he talks to some of these landowners around here who are second and third generation. He said, you know, some of us started at second base. Other people are still at home plate swinging, trying to make contact, you know, and I think it's the same with soil. You know, some people like in Iowa or Minnesota or some of those places, they start at second base. Other places, they're still swinging at home plate trying to make contact. And you know, the analogy being that you have a lot less margin for error than maybe some other people do.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And even out here, you know, I've got a good friend. He's, you know, a first-generation farmer. I mean, that doesn't happen very often. You know, everybody starts on second, like you said. It's kind of hard to explain, but it's simple. You know, it's hard if you really want to take a look at everything, but the gist of it is, it's here's what we have. We have to make this last for not only us, but if we want my kids to farm or if they want to farm, and if their kids want to farm, you know, we can't go out and beat this soil type up that we have. I mean, we don't have a bank like in other parts of the country. It's our topsoil is what you see is what you get, and it's pretty light. So we really have to pay attention here. I wish that, you know, we live 50 miles west of here in Illinois where it's deep and flat and black, and, you know, we could concentrate on other things, but that's not the case.
Yeah, you've got to adapt to your environment. What are some of the benefits that you guys have seen? You mentioned, you know, almost a resurrection. What are some of the specific benefits that you have seen as a result of some of these different practices?
So the biggest one and the most obvious one is going to be the rye that we plant the soybeans into. One of those fields I was telling you about that was been pretty beat up, we sowed a pretty good rye cover crop on there. We took a backhoe out and we dug a soil pit. Everybody sees the soil pit on the ads or seed or whatever for cover crops. And we got down in there because I wanted to see what's going on my own ground instead of what's in a magazine. And you can follow these roots down, you know, at least 4 feet deep. And you can hold that soil and feel the tilt in it. And you can see some of the beneficial insects and bugs in there working. And then later on in the summertime when it gets dry, that matter rye, you can pick it up and you can find moisture in the ground where some other parts, you know, across the fence that doesn't have that, you know, it's hard as a rock. And, you know, we're still pumping moisture to the beans, and that translates to yield. And also with that, Matt, you know, we've had it where we don't have to make a second trip spraying. We just go around the edge of the field and hit the borders. You know, this year we had transitional soybeans planted into rye like that, which never got a spray because you can't. We had to have it hand weeded around the edges for ragweed, but economically, those beans were our most profitable beans, and just by the yield number, they were, you know, in the top three fields just because of being able to conserve moisture. We got really dry here in July and August.
Very cool. So this is the Working Cows podcast after all, and I really I'm as much of a soil nerd as the next guy, and really I think if you're gonna run cows, you really aren't a cowman, you're a grass man. And so these crops and these soils and this is your most precious resource. You know, you can replace genetics, you can replace cow herds, you can't replace soil. And so I do want to take a little bit of a turn back to the cow thing and just touch on one more thing listed on your Twitter profile, and that is in big all capital letters in your bio. It says beer cows. What's that all about?
So beer cows, we have a partnership with Triton Brewing Company in Indianapolis, and I was on Twitter one day and they said, hey, we need a farmer, our farmer quit. So I'm like, hey, you know, what's this all about? And they wanted somebody to come pick up their spent grains. So I said, well, let me come over there and check it out. I had it tested, and it tested like silage pretty much. So they've got 250-gallon chemical totes I cut the top off of. They fill them up at the brewery, then we turn them over out in the feedlot. And, you know, in addition to the free choice hay and the corn, they've got free choice beer mash, as we call it. So that's where the beer cows come from. It's a really good deal for the brewery and us. We get the feed for just going over and getting it, and they don't have to pay a big disposal bill. And, you know, it adds a little something to the diet. We originally started feeding it to our brood cows, and man, they had the slickest look on them. I mean, it kept them in really good shape. There's no alcohol in there, but if you want to know what it tastes like, it's like the consistency of oatmeal, a little bit drier, but with absolutely zero taste to it. Everything is cooked out of there.
True.
So, and one thing to relate the cows to all the soil stuff we talked to, you know, we've been starting to put in fences back. Everybody here has started ripping out fences, you know, when corn got really high a few years ago. The fences we're replacing are just because nobody took care of them before. So my favorite thing, even though that I enjoy a good piece of brisket or a great steak as much as the next person does, I think my favorite thing about cattle now is that they poop everywhere. And that's proven to be a quick way to jumpstart that soil biology. So if I can get a lot of pooping going on, we're in good shape.
Absolutely. Yep. I think maybe the third person that we've talked to that said something similar. You know, we had Paul Youngnich on. We talked about bale grazing. We had Derek Schwanebeck on from Nebraska, and he talked about how cows and kind of concentrating cows in an area can really kickstart that microbiome growing in the soil and really do some really good things for you as far as long-term sustainability and some of those things. So that's a very important point, and I appreciate you making it. It's kind of what we're all about here is putting our cows to work for us. That's where the name of the podcast came from, is Working Cows. We want them to work for us and do more than just require being fed.
Yeah, because if you look at it that way, it's really frustrating. And it's something that you have to do, and you keep going out there. But then you turn around and think of the benefits that these animals can bring you and the rest of your farming system. You scratch your head, and okay, there's a lot more profitability coming down the road in other forms from what they're doing now. And maybe this is something we need to keep at and, you know, build those fences back or be a little bit more intensive with our management and our grazing and a little bit more directional.
Sure. So what have been some of your influences as far as the different things that you have done, the changes you've made, or what caused you to be willing to even step out there and be the subject of the coffee shop gossip?
You know,
my dad, he's 62, I think, and he adopted no-till, you know, way back before I can remember. I mean, I think I was probably like five. But he wasn't afraid to step out there and do that, and he got the hang of it, and he learned it, and he's not one to always do what his dad did. And I think that kind of came to me through him. He's been really good about letting me try new things along the way. We farm together, so now we have to run our own ideas by each other, and sometimes one of us will shoot the other one down, but that's the way it goes, and unfortunately, he's right most of the time, probably his years of experience, but that's one of the influences. You know, we've always had cattle around here. I'm the fourth generation in Indiana. I mean, people talk about generational farming. It means a lot to some people. Some it doesn't. I don't know. We're here now, and this is what we're managing. We've got some good neighbors around here as far as they think outside the box. You know, maybe not immediate neighbors, but regionally. Got a good friend about 20 miles from here. He's always kicking up good ideas crop-wise, and he's actually the reason that we started going back to the non-GMO corn. He said, you know, why don't you feed this to your cattle and market it that way? And I'm like, you know, Scott, that's a really great idea. So, you know, you've got these people in your life here and there, and some of them drop a pretty good bomb on you, even though we don't know it at the time, and it translates to something really good for you.
Very cool. Any resources or things that you are using to continue your growth other than neighbors that you've already mentioned that you'd like to share?
You know, I think the biggest thing that I can say is, you know, build your network. It might not be 5 miles down the road. I drive over to Champaign, Illinois once a month, or once every 2 months, it seems, at least. There's a group of farmers from mostly Illinois, a couple of us in Indiana, and we're all on varying ends of the organic spectrum as far as getting started or really experienced. So you find a network like that, get into it, learn from other people, listen to what they have to say. You know, you can sort out what's going to work for you or what's not. You can sort out who to listen to and who not to listen to. Just really other people are your greatest resource, and learn what mistakes they've made. It's a lot easier to ask somebody 30 years older than you, hey, what's your biggest mistake, if you would tell me about it. And lots of times, if they know that you're going to listen, you want to learn from it, they'll tell you. And then it's just a lot easier to not try not to make that mistake after you hear from somebody instead of doing it on your own. And it really hurt.
Sure. How could people keep up with you if they wanted to see what you're up to?
Well, like you said earlier, you can follow me on Twitter at TheHippieFarmer. And you can check out our website, MillsLivestockLLC.com. Probably needs an update, but you can kind of get a gist of what we're doing on there.
Sounds good, Joe. I thank you for your time today. It's been an enjoyable experience, and we will link to all of those things in the show notes page at WorkingCows.net.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It was good talking with you.
This episode has been brought to you by Kamak Ranch Supply. Check out their website at KamakRanchSupply.com. Here's the deal about Kamak Ranch Supply. When you call and ask them about a product, there's no blank pause on the other end of the line because they don't understand the product that you just asked them about. If they are selling it, they understand it because they are producers, and Gary Kamak himself, the owner of Kamak Ranch Supply, is a producer. So if you want answers about the products you're calling to ask about from producers, call Kamak Ranch Supply or check out their website at KamakRanchSupply.com. Well, I really enjoyed that discussion with Joe. Just so many good things there about soil health and how we can use animals to positively impact all different kinds of land, not just grasslands, but croplands, row crops, and all those different things, as well as some of the interesting things they're doing in the way of local marketing. So I encourage you to check out their website, MillsLivestockLLC.com. I would also encourage you to check out the show notes page for this episode, WorkingCows.net/15, WorkingCows.net/15. Check that out as well. I will leave you with this from the MillsLivestockLLC.com website. This land is not ours, but ours to take care of. And since I preached on this text 2 weeks ago, I will leave you with this verse from Genesis 2:15. The Lord God took man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. This work that we're doing was God's idea. It was His design, and we are partnering with Him in the renewal of all things. So take heart, producers, and I will see you next week. Tune in then for a great episode with the chairman of the board of the South Dakota Grassland Coalition, Jim Falstick.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.